From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Merry Christmas. It's Here and Now. And we start the hour with a woman who is celebrating her first Christmas with her family in 16 years. Tanisha Bannister was sentenced to life in prison for conspiring to sell 50 grams of crack and 5 kilos of cocaine back in 2004. But she got a second chance earlier this year when she was released under a new federal law called the First Step Act. It was designed to address harsh sentencing laws that packed America's prisons during the war on drugs, and it has so far freed around 3,000 former federal inmates. Tanisha Bannister joins us from South Carolina Public Radio in Columbia. Thanks for joining us, and Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Merry Christmas to you also.
And what are you doing for Christmas this year? This is the first time you've been out of jail for Christmas in years.
It is. Such a exciting time of my life to be able to sit down at a table and with family and friends after for so long and enjoy Christmas with them and my 2-year-old grandson. Is just a feeling that's indescribable, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world.
What was it like to get out after all those years?
Oh my God, it's such a relief. Not just to myself, but to my family and friends, you know, because, as you know, things trickle down when things happen to one person in the family, such as myself.
Mm-hmm.
It was like my family was doing time with me. So it was great relief. And the way it happened, it couldn't have happened any better than it did. I got immediate release on May 1st. And, wow, it was just an awesome feeling. I'm just grateful for the First Step Act and the ones that play an intricate part in making it happen.
You were released along with some 3,000 other former federal inmates who are also going to be free this holiday season.
Yes, yes. And as a matter of fact, I was the first and only one that was released for the First Step Act in Bryan, Texas, where I was serving the ending of my sentence.
Mm-hmm. And was anyone waiting for you when you got out that day?
Actually, no, because when the judge signed my order around 1:30 that day, I had to be gone by 4 o'clock that same day. So it was like they had to give me a bus ticket. I had to pack, you know, and just leave. I only had time to call my mom and my kids to inform them of the great news. And basically, I was out the door.
And what was the first thing that you wanted to do on the other side?
Oh, I felt like I wanted to kiss the ground. It's like a different air that you breathe on the outside. And, I just wanted to be able to call my kids uninterrupted by a beep or a 15-minute phone call, you know, and just to catch up and bask in the glory and the joy that I was feeling and I can feel from them from my release.
So let's talk about what it's been like for you over the last many months to readjust. You're back home in Columbia, South Carolina. Have you been able to find a job?
Yes. Actually, I started doing hair immediately because while incarcerated, I got certification in cosmetology and also in personal training. So I came out doing hair and didn't find that too interesting. And there was a lot of things that happened when it came to my licensure for South Carolina versus where I'm certified in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing PCA work.
PCA meaning?
Personal care assistant.
Uh-huh.
Where I help care for the elderly and the disabled.
Uh-huh. And you're enjoying that?
I am, because it's such a great feeling to be able to help someone after so long, because if it wasn't for the ones that fought and helped the cause while I was incarcerated, I wouldn't be here giving this interview today.
What's the hardest part of readjusting been for you? Because a lot of people who get out after a long time behind bars have a very difficult time finding work, for example.
It is. It is. Especially when you don't have that support. Because as you know, when you go away to prison and you spend a significant time away from your family and loved ones, when you return to society and the household you left is no more, because things change, you know. Family members die. Children grow older and become one of themselves. And they're not the same 8 and 10-year-old that you left versus coming back home to a 25 and a 26-year-old. So that was something that I'm still trying to wrap my head around, that I'm not talking about talking to or dealing with young children. I'm dealing with young adults now. And we're often sometimes stigmatized by our past. And, you know, it can be hard because it's not that we come outside and look for a handout. We only sometimes need that hand up in the right direction, you know, just to be given that chance to be productive in society, which I know myself and I can speak for others are happy to do after being incarcerated for so long, you know, making cents on dollars and then coming home, be able to provide for yourself, provide for your loved ones, to work an honest job, to live a decent life. I find great joy in that. And, you know, a lot of people don't have that, the help that's needed, you know, to help you integrate back in society. And it's the small things. Their resources just not there, especially here in Columbia, South Carolina, where I'm located.
What's your relationship with your kids like now after so many years being behind bars and now seeing them as much older people? As you said, you know, they're not really kids anymore.
Exactly. Well, it's wonderful because I've always remained that parent, even being absent physically. I always stayed involved and tried to be that voice of reason to help guide them from the past mistakes that I've made so they wouldn't, you know, make those same mistakes that I have. And it's interesting at times, but as my children always told me, they hold no ill will towards me not being there.
Tanisha, I understand you also met President Trump earlier this year, who, along with his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, personally backed the First Step Act. What was that experience like?
Oh, my God. I didn't see that coming. If somebody would have told me 6 months ago that I'll be from prison standing on the stage with the president, shaking his hand, he's kissing me on the cheek and saying that he will back me in any endeavor that I want to embark on, was just an amazing feeling. And I know people have mixed feelings about the president, but, you know, there's one common goal when it comes to prison reform that I believe we can stand on, and that was the historic signing of the First Step Act. And if it wasn't for the president, I would still be serving over 5 years.
What would your message be to people who are still in prison right now, who weren't as lucky as you to be able to get released early, and may be in a similar situation to the situation that you were in before?
Hold fast to the faith that we profess, because I know the feeling. I was let down when it came to clemency under the former administration. I was given hope, and as of today, of course, I'm free, but, you know, my clemency still says pending. God always has a plan for us, and it's not in our timing. And after 16 and a half years, I can say without a doubt, if I didn't stand on my faith and kept hope alive, I would be probably in a dark place. So my advice to them is to continue to hold on and fight the good fight, and know that it's people like myself and others that will continue to be the voice for them to help laws change. And, you know, we just pray that one day soon that they will come up with something to gain relief from their sentence, as I and so many others have from the First Step Act, and be back united with their loved ones.
I want to ask you one more thing, Tanisha, which is that a lot of people who are listening to this have never been in prison, will never be in prison. What do you think that the vast majority of Americans need to know about the prison system that they don't?
Everything isn't always what it seems. What society needs to realize is there are some really good people that's incarcerated that deserve a second chance. And you have to keep those people in mind as humans, because oftentimes we're dehumanized by the crimes we commit or the perception of who we are. And prison can make you a better person and shape you into the person you were meant to be, because I myself can say I've come to common ground with the person I feel like I was meant to be. And In the beginning, when I first was sentenced to life, my judge, which is a really good judge, and I know it might be hard to believe for me to say this for someone that sentenced me to life in prison without mm-hmm. the possibility of parole. At that time, she was doing her job. She was standing on the right side of the law. And when the First Step Act was passed, she was still standing on the right side of the law and applied it where she saw fit to my case, which gave me immediate release.
That is Tanisha Bannister, who is celebrating her first Christmas with her family in nearly two decades in South Carolina after being released from prison under the First Step Act earlier this year. Tanisha, thanks so much for speaking with us, and best of luck to you.
Oh, thanks for having me. God bless. Happy holidays again.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
American distillers are breathing easier after Congress approved an extension for a tax cut that benefits their industry just days before it was set to expire. The measure was part of a larger spending bill passed last week, and it maintains a tax break for some alcohol producers first put in place as part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. One place where that tax cut has a big impact is Kentucky. According to that state's Distillers Association, more than 20,000 people are employed directly or indirectly by the liquor industry. And in Kentucky, that, of course, means bourbon. Earlier this year, we visited Louisville for a closer look at how bourbon is made. There are more than 7 million barrels of bourbon in the state of fewer than 5 million people. Bourbon was born in Kentucky, and today the industry is in the middle of a renaissance, even as trade disputes and tariffs threaten growth. But wherever that glass of bourbon is eventually served, it all starts with a 3-foot-high white oak barrel.
What makes Kentucky stand out from all the whiskey-producing regions in the world is we alone always use a new charred barrel.
Chris Morris is master distiller at Brown-Forman, the company behind Jack Daniel's, Old Forester, Woodford Reserve, and many more liquor brands sold around the world. They do that in a cooperage, that's a barrel-making facility, in an old World War II-era factory near the Louisville airport. Until 1945, the military used this brick warehouse to manufacture rifle stocks and plywood parts for airplanes.
Yes, after the end of the war, the military supply contracts were ended, and we, Brown-Forman, purchased the plant and converted it into a barrel cooperage, and it's been making whiskey barrels ever since.
For longer than anywhere else in America.
Yes, and not only are we the oldest cooperage, but we are also the only whiskey maker who owns a cooperage making new barrels.
Chris Morris takes us inside, where dozens of workers, including one man who's been working here for 50 years, put these barrels together with their hands and machines. They have to make sure that the 33 or so staves of wood that make up the barrel fit together perfectly and can be bound by metal hoops. If there's a crack in any of the wood, the bourbon will leak out. They test that by putting water in the barrel. If there is a leak, a cooper goes to a wall of wood, finds a piece that perfectly matches the damaged stave, and replaces it. Once the barrel is perfect, it's sent across the factory floor on a series of tracks and conveyor belts to an oven where the interior of the barrel is blasted with fire to toast and char the wood. If it weren't for this process, bourbon wouldn't have its color or its flavor. That's why these barrels will have a life even after the bourbon has been consumed.
Once we've used the barrel one time only, the wood still has a long life potential ahead of it. And that can be realized if you ship it to Scotland or Ireland or Canada, or even to other spirit-making producing regions such as Mexico or the Caribbean for rum and tequila. They use our barrels.
But it's all about the barrel.
Yes, it is. Many spirits, all spirits, I should say, leave the stills clear. And if they have any color, there's only one way it's going to get color, and that's from wood. Now, you can add a little caramel coloring to it, but that's going to be secondary. We add no color because we, again, we're Kentucky bourbon. We're 100% natural. We add nothing to our product.
Of course, something has to go into the barrel to make bourbon, and that's where distilleries come in. For that part of the process, we visited another bourbon maker called Michter's.
We'll walk inside the still room.
Andrea Wilson is Master of Maturation and Executive Vice President for Michter's, whose origins date back to the 18th century. She says whiskey starts as a mixture of grains called mash. For it to become bourbon, that mash has to be at least 51% corn. Other whiskeys usually use other grains like rye, malted barley, or wheat. Distillers boil that mash and condense the resulting vapor into what they call low wine.
Then we take that low wine, we introduce it to our pot still doubler, which is like a second refinement step or a second distillation. Gets boiled up as different compounds hit their boiling point again. They become vapor, go up to the second condenser, condense, and then they come back down, and that's what we call high wine. That's what will be evaluated for quality prior to reduction and entry into the barrel.
Then the barrels are filled with clear whiskey and hammered shut. Each barrel holds about 53 gallons of liquor and weighs about 500 pounds, so they have to be rolled along steel tracks and lifted by machines onto storehouse racks. There, they'll spend at least 5 years aging. Andrea Wilson at Michter's Distillery is also on the board of the Kentucky Distillers Association. She says 95% of the world's bourbon is made right here in Kentucky, but not all of it.
Under the U.S. law, you can produce bourbon in any of the 50 U.S. states. It was made America's native spirit in 1964. And it can be produced in any of the 50 U.S. states. But to be a Kentucky straight bourbon, you need to be produced in Kentucky.
What's the state of the industry right now? I know that the growth has been really strong over the last many years, but then, of course, along came the trade war, which has targeted bourbon specifically.
So, yeah, for Kentucky, it is a tremendous business. It's an $8.6 billion business for the state. It employs over 20,000 people. So we're very fortunate to be in an American whiskey boom. Right now, there's 7.5 million barrels of bourbon aging in Kentucky, which is the highest since 1972. So it gives you an indication of how American whiskey is going through this renaissance or essentially this growth.
Because of customers both here in the United States, but also around the world.
That's correct. And it's an amazing time for the export market. You know, trade wars are not good for anyone. No one really benefits either side. So we definitely look for the opportunity for leaders to figure out, you know, mutually beneficial outcomes that lead to stable trade policy across the globe. And I think that's going to be incredibly important. We have seen, even last year, we saw 30% growth in our export markets.
Amid the trade war.
Amid all of that. So, you know, we do definitely feel like, you know, our product is underpinned by quality, and people are having discerning palates globally for quality, and they're willing to pay for it.
Kentucky's most famous tourist attraction is probably still the Kentucky Derby, but more people visit the state each year as bourbon tourists.
We're seeing over 1 million people now coming to Kentucky for the sole purpose of visiting the Kentucky Bourbon Trail, which is incredibly amazing. People want to learn more about Kentucky bourbon, and it's an exciting time. We just opened our Michter's Fort Nelson Distillery in downtown Louisville at 8th and Main. But what you're seeing is bourbon is really underpinning tourism. Our Louisville mayor calls it bourbonism. He coined the term. And I think it's brilliant because it really showcases how people are coming for the purpose of seeing the bourbon distilleries, but they're also experiencing hospitality culture, bars, restaurants. You know, we have this whole beautiful foodie culture as well, and it's an amazing time.
Once someone becomes a bourbon tourist, they're already interested in the drink. What many in the industry here are focused more on right now is convincing new customers around the world to give bourbon a try. Jackie Zykin is a master taster for Old Forester.
Well, I mean, there's still a lot of people that are still kind of scared to try it. I think a lot of people are still under this old umbrella of thought that it's this big cowboy juice diesel fuel product, and it's not. There's a lot of subtleties, and there's actually a lot of notes in there that if you broke down bourbon and described it by its different little palatable flavor compounds, people would be like, well, I like vanilla. Well, I like cinnamon. Well, I like butterscotch. Well, I like citrus. I like all of those things, so therefore you technically, I guess, would enjoy a glass of bourbon because that's all there and present.
And she's just talking about plain old bourbon, not a mint julep or an old-fashioned, which brings me to my last question for Andrea Wilson.
Do you think it's a shame after all the work that goes into one of these barrels when somebody makes a mixed drink with your bourbon?
I don't see it. I wouldn't use that terminology at all. I think what's important is that everybody's palate is different, and how you experience your bourbon is your own personal experience. I think that what I always encourage people to do is taste bourbon neat, so you understand the spirit and understand what took years to develop in the barrel, and then create what you like. I mean, bartenders have done a brilliant job of supporting this industry all over the world by bringing back classic cocktails and using natural ingredients and bringing creativity and artistry to the drink. And that's tremendously important to our business. So however you want to drink it is your choice.
How do you drink it?
I drink it neat.
There you go. See, that from the experts, neat.
Neat.
And neat it is when it goes from those barrels into bottles after years of aging. Then packed into a cardboard box and perhaps trucked right across the street to a waiting UPS plane. Louisville is the worldwide air hub for the shipping company, after all, and then sent all over the world. I'd raise a glass now, but I'm at work. You can see pictures and video of the barrel making and distilling processes at hereandnow.org. Each winter, steam rises from manholes in cities across the U.S., part of an underground system that heats buildings. But in Denver, because of economics and fixes to climate change, that system may be on its way out. Sam Brash of Colorado Public Radio reports.
If you live in New York, Minneapolis, or San Francisco, you're probably familiar with steam rising from the streets. Each of these cities and many others have what's called district heating systems, networks of underground pipes delivering hot steam to heat buildings. But Denver's steam system is special. It's been churning away since 1880, making it the oldest continually operated steam system in the country.
When you say old, it brings in a whole different connotation. You
know, it's historic.
Yes, thank you.
This is Jerome Davis, Regional Vice President for Xcel Energy. The utility owns and operates this historic system, and recently it added some upgrades.
It's always kind of fun to get something new.
Xcel engineer Tim Brown shows me the main improvement at the Denver steam plant. It's a new boiler about a story and a half tall, and if you look through a peephole on its side, you can see a blaze of natural gas-fed flames.
So we're boiling water, we're making steam.
And here's where the future of Denver's steam system gets a little dicey. In other cities like Boston and Toronto, private investors have paid to bring old steam systems into the 21st century. In Denver, customers picked up the bill. Earlier this year, Xcel raised steam rates 36%, leading some to wonder if steam can stay viable in Denver. Jerome Davis, the Xcel executive, says his company will continue to provide the option.
We could easily say, oh, no more, we're not going to provide that service to you anymore. You got to figure something else out. I don't think that's the way you would want to talk to a customer, right?
But buildings are leaving the system. In the last decade, about 10% of customers have gone off steam. Energy consultant Joe Havey says the biggest reason is just plain economics.
Just recently, in the last 9 months, I'm getting an inordinate amount of phone calls about this.
Those calls came after Xcel hiked its steam rates. Havey thinks the concerns could be the beginning of the end for steam in Denver.
Buildings will leave the steam system, convert to either gas heat or electric heat, and then Xcel will be left with fewer and fewer customers to charge their fixed cost to, so those steam rates will continue to go even higher.
But some say now is the exact wrong time for Denver or any city to walk away from steam heat. Rob Thornton leads the International District Energy Association.
Cities turned to district energy really as an environmental strategy by centralizing the production. It gave them better control over emissions and eliminated hundreds of coal-fired boilers dotted around the city.
Today, scientists think those same benefits make district heat a great way for cities to combat climate change. It's efficient, it's easily regulated, and if a city wants to create heat without fossil fuels, say with trash incineration or electricity from renewables, it just has to swap out a few big boilers.
I think the Denver system could continue to be of value to the customers and environmentally responsible asset.
But even with the recent improvements, Denver's system could be doomed. And it's not just the economics. The city has a goal to cut greenhouse gas emissions 80% by 2050. To get there, it's exploring whether to require electric heat in commercial buildings. And that could finally put an end to Denver's steam system and its winter street clouds. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Brash.
On this Christmas day, we ask the question, what makes people happy? Is it that gift under the tree? Maybe, maybe not. It's a question that many people have tried to figure out, and now researchers have surveyed available data to get some answers. Derek Thompson has been looking at the results. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us from Washington. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And Merry Christmas to you.
And Merry Christmas.
So when you look around the world, first of all, which countries do people tend to rank the happiest? It's all those Scandinavian places.
Yes. According to the World Happiness Report, every single year, it is indeed very, very annoying to read that over and over and over it's those Scandinavian countries that finish at the top of the list. In the most recent report, it was Finland, followed by Denmark, followed by Norway. There's another list, though, that I'm really interested in, which is the OECD Better Life Index. If a listener is at home, he or she can play along with this index because it's interesting. It allows you to toggle different variables up and down depending on what happiness means to you. And whenever we talk about happiness, I think it's really important to remember that we're not just all one, you know, automaton that has the exact same definition of what makes us happy. We have different ideas about what makes us happy. So, for example, let's say that what you really cared about was the environment and a work-life balance and safety. Well, then yes, living in a Scandinavian country might predictably make you the most happy. But if you said, what I really care about is living in a big house with lots of amenities and making a good deal of money, well, if you toggle up on housing and income, guess which country finishes number one in the world? It's the good old US of A. So it depends on what you value in life in terms of what country is going to give you sort of the best suite of services to make you happy.
What countries score the lowest in happiness?
The countries that score the lowest tend to be the poorest countries. I mean, this is the general rule that rich countries are happier than poorer countries, and rich groups within rich countries are happier than poor groups within poor countries. That, yes, everything that we know that makes us happy and that feels cuddly and warm and true, you know, relationships make you happy, friendships make you happy, good marriages make you happy, that is, of course, true. Meaning seems to make us happy, feeling like we have purpose, both at our jobs and in our non-professional lives, that makes us happy. But the cold, hard fact is that money also makes us happy. And while we used to think that there was some line at which money stopped making us happy. The old estimate was about $70,000 to $75,000. More recent research suggests that, unfortunately, the more money you make after you earn $75,000, the happier you are. But when you add it all up, the money and the relationships and the meaning, that essentially is as close as we get to a formula for happiness.
I think a dog also makes me happy.
Sorry, and a dog. Yes, exactly. There's some late-breaking research that just came in that said money plus relationships plus meaning plus dog.
Plus dog. They also, these researchers, looked at something called happiness inequality. What is that, and why is it falling in the U.S.?
So happiness inequality is the idea that different groups within a country might have really different levels of happiness. Say, for example, that white Americans are much happier than black Americans, or that men are less happy than women. There is some recent research that suggests, rather happily, that happiness inequality is declining, that these groups are averaging out. Now, sometimes it's because groups that used to be happier are declining in happiness, and a little bit of it is the fact that groups like, you know, black Americans that used to be less happy are getting more happy as they earn more money, potentially. But what we are seeing, at least in the U.S., is that happiness inequality does seem to be declining.
So when you take it down to the micro level and look at individuals, Derek, individual people, life events, marriage, divorce, having a kid, how do these things tend to impact our happiness?
Yeah, this is the stuff that really interests me, is looking at the effects of life events on life satisfaction, things like marriage, having a kid, divorce. And what is interesting about the research that I've seen is that it suggests that happiness is mostly homeostatic. It's like a thermostat of happiness in our bodies. It's hard for single events to permanently affect life satisfaction because, for better or worse, humans are overall surprisingly resilient. So marriage, for example, seems to make people happier about a year after the event, and then they come right back down to homeostasis. Divorce has the opposite effect. It makes people sad in the aftermath of the divorce, but then they come right back essentially to homeostasis. Having a kid as well seems to basically have people hovering around homeostasis. The one thing that we seem uniquely unresilient to is long-term unemployment. And there's a lot of research that I've read and written about this, and it's really interesting and somewhat depressing. And not so depressing if you have an unemployment rate as we do of 3.5%, but really depressing when unemployment starts to rise and you have long-term unemployment becoming a scourge across the country. People are more resilient to events like the loss of a loved one than they are to something like long-term unemployment. And I think a really critical part of this is the fact that we go right back to my first formula, money plus relationships plus meaning. If you are long-term unemployed, but you're, you know, in your 30s or 40s, then you don't have money coming in, and you also don't have the relationships and meaning that is often sort of tied up and bound up in a job. A job isn't just money, it's also purpose.
Well, and the meaning is really crucial there because no matter what you do, at least you wake up in the morning and you say, I need to accomplish this thing today. I'm going to do this today. And by the end of the day, hopefully, you will say, I made some progress on this thing that I have to do. I have meaning in my life.
That is absolutely it. And there's other research that looks at how humans think about time, and in particular about excess time. The concept of feeling rushed makes us unhappy, but nothing makes us less happy than feeling like we have lots of unwanted excess time. And people that are long-term unemployed don't have that. So, I mean, there really is no formula for unhappiness stronger than long-term unemployment. And if you internalize this, I think, if anybody's listening or works at the Federal Reserve or for the federal government in Washington, D.C., or for governments across the country, it is so important to think about employment as not just an economic policy, but as a policy that goes so deeply to human happiness.
So if long-term unemployment makes people unhappy for a long time, is there anything that can make you happy in a long-term basis? Not just like a marriage, as you said, or having a child where you might have a temporary bump in happiness and then it comes back to normal.
Right. I mean, we're getting at the million-dollar question here, which is what is the secret to long-term happiness? And, you know, I sometimes tell my friends, or I'll hear them tell me, that if this one thing happens, I'll be happy. You know, like we've all sort of felt this from time to time. If I get to the end of the week, I'll be happy. If he texts me back, if she agrees to go on that second date, if she marries me, if we have a kid, if I get this job, this promotion, this raise, this title, then that is the gateway beyond which lies true and lasting happiness. This is the lie we tell ourselves. But the truth is that life doesn't agree with that kind of hopeful thinking. In reality, there is no one gateway. There are just gateways, one after another. And you realize that it's basically just gateways all the way down. So what psychologists tend to think about in terms of long-term happiness isn't so much about, oh, if you accomplish this one goal, then you have purchased the ticket to permanent life satisfaction. No, they say you need to develop habits that will allow you to pass through these gateways in such a way as to maintain the level of happiness that you have. There is no magic pill. There is no golden ticket. There is just the work of passing one gateway after another.
Can you look at all of the results and say that people are either getting happier or less happy over time?
It does seem to be the case that people are generally more satisfied with life around the world. And this partly gets the fact that the first ingredient of the happiness formula is money. Around the world, even though global GDP isn't growing that much, it is growing. And it's growing by a lot in countries in, say, Asia and Africa and South America. So, you know, if you believe that, you know, the modern world is just beset by alienation and a destruction to modern relationships that is being fed into by, I don't know, social media, for example, then that is certainly something that you could argue is pulling down happiness. But something that certainly is pulling it up is the fact that people overall are getting richer. We are moving up, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We have more people with health care, more people who can eat and aren't starving, more people moving out of poverty. That should, according to the formula, according to the studies that we have, make the world a happier place.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, and we will link you to more of this research on happiness at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks again, and Merry Christmas.
Or as they say in England, Happy Christmas.
That's true. Candy canes, Christmas cookies, sweets are everywhere during the holiday season, which means there are a lot of adults and kids getting sugar highs. But what about those artificial food dyes that are in many of those sweets? Well, some studies are showing that they, too, can increase hyperactivity in children. Leslie McClurg of member station KQED explains.
Shopping for sweets is tricky for Alex Bevins. The 14-year-old scrutinizes a bag of lollipops at Save Mart in Carson City, Nevada.
Get this. It has red 40, red 3, yellow 5, blue 1, blue 2 lake, yellow 6 lake, yellow 6.
Yeah, that is absolutely toxic. Yeah.
That's Alex's mom, Rebecca. She says her son is highly sensitive to food coloring. Each pigment sends him on a different ride.
So red,
hyper.
Green,
mania.
Blue,
it's down in the dumps, really.
And yellow, angry outbursts.
Hate for every living thing.
Rebecca remembers the moment she began connecting her son's diet to strange behaviors. Alex was in second grade. He complained he couldn't focus because his brain was buzzing.
It's like if you played a decibel machine and you just kept turning the tone and the sound up, it just got really ear-piercing.
He melted down multiple times a day.
Screaming and crying and just being completely out of control with my own body.
Rebecca shudders as she recounts one episode when Alex was 7. He was shredding his clothes and scratching himself on his bed.
And he looked at me and said, please get me a knife. I want to kill myself. I don't want to live like this anymore.
Rebecca felt helpless. Her doctors didn't have answers, so she scoured the internet. One night, she stumbled across a teenager's blog that rang a bell. The tale suggested food coloring could be why Alex struggled with erratic mood swings. The next morning, Rebecca threw out everything from popsicles to popcorn.
And he crashed.
Alex was like an addict detoxing.
I had no stamina, no strength.
He was even sore to the touch. But the good news was,
the suicidal thoughts and the tantrums ended within 5 days.
And after 6 months?
It completely changed who I was. I could finally be able to focus for once.
We've been contacted by over 2,000 families reporting their experiences with food dyes.
Lisa Lefferts works for the advocacy group Center for Science in the Public Interest.
When their child is off a dyes, they're just, you know, lovely children. And on dyes, they're like a completely different person.
Artificial food coloring is made from petroleum. The Federal Food and Drug Administration approves its use to enhance the color of processed stuff. Leffert says it's in 40% of foods marketed to kids. It's found in surprising items like sunscreen, cough syrup.
Even things like pickles or salad dressing.
Leffert's group is lobbying federal officials to add a warning label to these products. That's what they do in Europe.
So in Europe, it says that those dyes may have an adverse effect on attention and activity in children.
Jim Coughlin says that's going way too far. He's an independent nutritional toxicology consultant.
To put a consumer warning across every food and beverage product that contains a synthetic color, we would be way overstating the risk. It's not scientifically justified at this point.
The FDA reviewed 35 years of research and determined there was not enough evidence to prove artificial dyes cause hyperactivity. That was in 2011. Since then, Joel Nigg also did a comprehensive review of the research. He's a psychologist at Oregon Health and Science University.
Because the studies are small and outdated, one can question whether they are convincing, but they do show a causal effect if one wants to believe them.
Nigg estimates that about 1 in 20 kids with ADHD is likely sensitive to chemical dyes. That's a small percentage, but
you're still talking tens of thousands of children that could have a preventable influence on their ADHD.
And that doesn't explain cases like Alex, who doesn't have a neurological or learning disorder. The data is far from perfect. But Nigg says you can't ignore the information that suggests food coloring is not benign.
And I think we'll be surprised in the future that we were so laissez-faire about adding so many synthetic chemicals and thinking they wouldn't do anything to children's brains.
That's why the issue is back on the table at the state and federal level. California state scientists are in the midst of reviewing the latest human and animal studies. They expect a conclusive report by summer. As they wrap up their shopping, the Bevins head to the freezer section. Alex picks up a pint of Monster Cookie flavor ice cream.
My surprise. There's no dyes in here, actually.
Beet juice, beta-carotene, turmeric, spirulina extract.
Rebecca wishes more companies added natural dyes to create vibrant colors. She tosses the pint in her cart. For Here and Now, I'm Leslie McClurg in Carson City.
And thanks to our holiday staff at Here and Now, Emiko Tamagawa, Frankie Paris, Karen Miller-Medson, Cassidy Rosenblum, Mark Navin, Todd Munt, Kathleen McKenna, James Trout, Mike Moschetto, Serena McMahon, Eileen Balinski, and the dogs of Here and Now, here with us today, Louie, Gilda, Cricket, and Midas. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Merry Christmas. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.